भद्रं हरणे विश्वयामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैः सुष्ठुवागुंसस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्ति
We're on verse 12, the last section of verse 12. But we'll just repeat the whole mantra. This is actually the last mantra of the Upanishad. Amatraha. I'm going to break the sandhi, so just repeat after me. Amatraha.
Amatraha.
Chaturtaha.
Chaturtaha.
Avyavahariyaha.
Avyavahariyaha.
Prapancho Pashamaha Shivaha Dvaitaha Evam Omkaraha Atmaiva Samvishati Atmana Atmanam Yaha Evam Veda. So let me just retranslate the first section and then we're going to work on the last part of it, okay? So the last verse of the Upanishad is dealing with Chaturtaha, the fourth pada, which is Amatra. Amatra means there is no letter. There's no signifier. So the resolve into that which has no matra. And so the amatraha, in terms of the silence, is the amatra. Here the amatraha is the chaturtaha, the fourth. It's four. One, two, three, four. Chaturta means four. So the amatraha is the chaturtaha. And that silence in which the omkara resolves is avyavaharya. In other words, from the standpoint of silence, nothing is being done. There's no activity at all. Nothing comes from silence, and nothing resolves into silence. Vyavahara means activity. That kind of in sometimes the word vyavahara actually means business, the business that we carry on in the world. In avyavaharya, there is no duality for there to be any type of carrying on of anything. Right, so avyavaharya is so interesting. Silence, even when you say the om, the a-u-m, om, resolves into silence. And then we can say the om comes from silence. Which is fine to say that, but it's only from the standpoint of the omkara. Silence isn't doing anything. Right, the silence isn't participating in the rising and the falling. Or the rising of and the falling of the omkara. Rising means coming into existence and going out of existence. The self, or the silence here, is non-participatory in that. But the silence is the very being in which the omkara exists. In fact, all sound takes place in silence. I almost pointed this out in the meditation today, that as we become very quiet and kind of aware of your own presence, which is silence. It's the very silence in which all of the sound is taking place. And in fact, without that silence, you couldn't hear sound because it'd be too noisy. Right? Sound must take place in silence for it to even be known. And so the very adhishtana, I mean, the very support of all sound is silence, which is non-participatory. But without the silence, there's no sound, really. There's no sound to be heard, let's put it that way. The sound is the very being, which is the support, the adhishtana, of the silence. And you notice in reference to your own self, say when you're doing a meditation or when we do the japa mantra the repetition of a mantra or anything like that is so, just so useful to see all of your thoughts, all of your experiences taking place in the silence of your being, right? Everything is rising and setting in the silence of your being. Being itself is not noisy, and being itself is not rising and setting. But every experience that you have takes place in that being. In fact, the being is what we call the adhishtana. The being means the existence. That existence, if I put it personally, that existence is my own amness. The amness is just the person, the first person singular, right? I am is the first person singular of is. I am, it is, you are. All of these are just terms for being itself. And that being is so well known to me as amness, my own being. I don't know experientially isness. I only know amness. I can say, this is, the rug is, the chair is, etc. But I'm only labeling names and forms. I can't say, see, this is, do you see the isness which it's enjoying? I can say, here's the name and form. But there is no objectification of being. In fact, the only being that I know is the self-evident being of me, which I call I am, my own amness. So being, in fact, and amness are one and the same thing. It's just that when I use the word amness, am, it as though divides being from is. If I say I am, then I'm only talking about me in the language, right? But now what I'm saying is that the amness which I enjoy is the only experience of being that we have. And we give that amness to everything that we experience because there's no dividing line between your experience of being in terms of this body, mind, sense organs. It doesn't all of a sudden go through a shift as you come outside of the body. Like there's no experiential shift in being except in terms of language. There's no experiential shift. You don't go, now here's the amness and am is, as though there's some sort of a modification that goes on there. There's nothing. The being that I experience is self-evident and everything takes place in it. It rises in it and it sets in it. Every experience that you have has being as what we call the adhishtana, the very base, the very truth of that experience, of the experiences, but itself goes through no modification, no change. Nothing happens to it. And so it's avyavahariyaha. It's not engaged in any way. It is ever present, but ever unengaged. So no business going on for your being. Still and steady. Avyavahariyaha. It is prapancha, so remember we're on this chaturta, we're on the fourth quarter in reference to the omkara. It is prapancha upashama. Remember one other thing here. The omkara, the kara means the syllable om, the letter om, is Brahman. Let me put it like this. The a of om is virat, right? It is the manifest creation, and the manifest creation is the akara. The ukara, the letter u, is Hiranyagarbha, is the subtle aspect of the creation, the total. The makara is Ishwara. So when you say om, when you say the om, that word om is the name for this creation. And the silence, when you say om, that point of resolution into the silence, that silence is Brahman. And so there's a lot of unfoldment, especially at the very beginning of the Upanishad, that discusses the relationship between the Abhidhana and the Abhideya. Abhidhana is the name, Abhideya is the thing that's named. Right? So chair is the Abhidhana, the actual chair, the Abhidhana, the name chair, is the name, of the actual thing. So chair, the word chair refers to this, and this chair is this, and this is a chair. Seems simple, right? Chair, C-H-A-I-R, is this, and this is a chair. So the word actually resolves into the thing that it's naming. And so if I say lamp, right, the word lamp lands on this, and this is a lamp. L-A-M-P is this, and this is L-A-M-P. It's a lamp. See what I mean? This is the relationship between a word and its object, any word. And so now when you say the word Om, and the whole Upanishad is unfolding the word Om, the syllable, very sacred syllable Om, as A-U-M, comprised of these four mantras, these four letters A-U-M, and the A-mantra, that silence that's not contained by any letter, A-mantra. The A-mantra actually is there to be found in all of the other three letters, the A-U-M. So that these four mantras, the A, U, M, and the silence, are the name for Brahman. Brahman, which has these, the Brahman, which is Atma, the limitless self, which is this self, Brahman, which is this very self, which can be seen as the self in the form of this creation, Virat, that very self, as Hiranyagarbha, the subtle creation, that very self as Ishwara, as the Maya Upadhi from which this whole creation comes. So when I say Om, it's not just a syllable, Om. It's not just a sound. It is a sacred sound also. But for a jnani, when you say Om, what comes is the whole knowledge of all of the Upanishads. It is the Om stands for everything that is taught in all of the Upanishads. So that when you say Om, in this one little syllable, you have the knowledge that the knowledge of all of the Mahavakyas, the knowledge of everything that's being revealed by the Upanishad, which is the nature of your being, the Atma, which is the self and the truth of the whole creation and everything that exists. So that's why this Upanishad is so sacred, because in the end, by the end of the Upanishad with the Karika, if you say Om, then you're just holding in this one syllable the entirety of your knowledge. So it's a beautiful thing that way. So he says, Prapancha Upashamaha. That Om, that fourth pada, is where this creation resolves. Is the Maya Upadhi, kind of like where the snake resolves into the rope, that the whole creation resolves into the self. The self is its truth. So Prapancha means the creation, all duality, the whole Maya Upadhi. Everything resolves into that which is Shivaha. Shiva really means the Ananda Swarupa, that which is most auspicious. What is most auspicious is Ananda. You say, what is auspicious? Auspicious is Ananda. Ananda is that wholeness, that absolute fullness, which sometimes we call the beloved. Right? That is what is Shiva. The Ananda, the wholeness, the fullness, which is the very nature of the self. And that self is Advaitaha. That self is non-dual, one without a second. So he says, Evam Omkara, in this manner, the Omkara, this letter Om, this sacred syllable Om, is the Atma alone. So the Atma is the Omkara is the Atma. And so in talking about this Amatra, the fourth pada, it's just a description of Brahman. It's just relating the Amatra to Brahman, to the self, which is Brahman, this fourth pada. And now, as in all the previous verses, he says, and this is where we are picking up, Yaha Evam Veda, he who knows, he or she, I'll say, he who knows in this manner, he who knows this, who understands this, then Atma, that one who knows, samvishati atmana atmanam. He who knows in this manner, he enters the self, atmanam, accusative singular, atmana, by means of the self. He enters the self by the self. Okay, so there are two different ways. Swamiji's dealt with this in two different ways. I'm going to do both of them. When he was teaching me this Upanishad, teaching us back in the 70s, that's the first way I'm going to do it. The second way I'm going to do it is the way that he's recently done it. But both are perfect. Both are perfectly fine. So, say if I say, instead of he or she enters the self, because it says, he who knows in this way, he enters samvishati, and samvishati means enters without ever returning. I'll talk about that too. Samvishati means to enter. Samvishati means to enter really well. It means you're not going to come back. To enter in and not come back. So he who enters the self without ever coming back, he who knows this, enters the self by the self, never come back again. Okay, so you can take he enters the self. How can the self enter the self? First of all, yourself can't enter yourself because yourself already is yourself. So we can take there, and often this is the case, you can take the Atmana in the instrumental to be by the mind in this sense, by the mind as an akanda akara vritti. Through the akanda akara vritti, so this is a term that's often used, through the akanda akara vritti, right, one enters the self by means of the mind, which has that vritti. Now this is the problem. Yourself can't enter the self because yourself is the self. You know? And so how is it that we can even talk about entering the self? We have to talk about entering the self from the standpoint of the one who has ignorance, who has self-ignorance. Because the one who has self-ignorance takes themselves not to be the self, but to be the mind, the mind-body-sense organs. So in thinking of the whole thing as mind-body-sense organs, we'll just talk about it from the standpoint of the mind, which is the one who has this mistake. Right? So the mind is the conscious mind has this mistake. Using the sense organs, it perceives the world and the body. But the mind itself is the one that has ignorance of the self, and what that has self-ignorance. And what that self-ignorance looks like is the mind's, what we call, mutual superimposition brought about by ignorance, allowing the mind itself to say, I am the conscious being. I am the self, and I am having these thoughts. I am feeling in this way. I have these emotions. And so I, this conscious being, am the thinking, feeling self. And then I go on, of course, to say, which is here now, because I have this physical body. So this think it's like a bouncing ball. This thinking, feeling self exists because the physical body exists, and when the physical body dies, this thinking, feeling self in the form of my mind may or may not continue living. If there is a soul, as some of the religions say, then it may go to heaven or hell, or it may transmigrate. But all I know is right now I am the conscious being who is either happy or sad or depressed or smart or stupid or whatever the qualities of the mind are. That's what we call mutual superimposition. So the mind itself now is its own entity. Right? It is its own entity, and from the standpoint of the mind, there is a self to be known. Right? I want to know the self which is free, or I want to know the self which is Brahman. So the mind, which itself takes itself to be a conscious being, wants to know the self which is infinite. The Atma, the mind which takes itself to be the Atma, wants to know the Brahman, the infinite self. And then it uses language and even believes, picks up this type of language where I being the mind, I want to have union with God. I want to unite with God. Or I want to merge into the big self, like a river merging into the ocean. I want to flow into, to merge in, to become one with the self, with the infinite self. I want to merge into or become one, to absorb myself into the infinite self. So this language is quite common, actually. So now, if we take it like this, the mind wants, the mind that takes itself to be separate, right, now has to enter into the self as though. So if we look like that, or say the mind itself, you know, he enters the self by means of the mind, by the antakarana, which gains through teaching what we call an akhandakara vritti. Okay. Akhandakara vritti is actually how this knowledge takes place, because in fact what the mind has to recognize is that the self, it has to recognize this satya-mitya relationship, where the mind recognizes that the self that I am, the very self that I am, is the self which is infinite. The self, or let me put it in this way, it has to recognize that the self that I am is the self in all beings. The self that I am, remember, it's hard for the mind, because the mind thinks that the self that I am, it's like the pot thinking, you know, I'm the clay type of thing. That, well, let me, don't go there right now. the mind thinks the self that I am belongs to me, and the self that you are belongs to you. But the teaching is this: the mind, the self that I am, that part is true, the self that I am. But the difference here is that the self that I am is the self in all beings. Not the self that I am is like the self in all beings, so that we all have identical selves. That's not what it is. It's this self that I am, the I, the conscious being that is me, that this me is the me of the whole universe. It is the me of Virat. It is the me of the... A Virat means the whole physical universe, and it is the me of the Vishwa, the waker in the waking state. It is the me not only of the waker in the waking state, it is the me of the waking state. Right? It's like I would think, I am me sitting here, and you are you sitting there. But no, the me that I am is the me of the whole room, right? And of everybody in it. So now, to extend it even further, the me that I am, that is me, this me is the me of the waker, but it is also the me of the whole waking world. And not only that, this me, that is the me of the waker and the waking world, this me is the me of the dreamer and the dream world. It's not just the dreamer. It's the dreamer and the dream world. Another way I could say it, this me that is me, the dreamer, is also the me of the world in which the dreamer is, if you want to say it that way. Because the dreamer is contained in the dream world. The waker is contained in the waking world. So I am the self of the waker who is in the waking world. Right? But that's, you have to say it, see it, that can get problematic. So you can say the waker is in the waking world. I am the self of the waker and the self of the waking world. There's one self. That one self is the self of the waking world in which the... That's another way you can say it. Because language can... You can always escape. You know, you can find a little place to hide in the language. So if you say, I am the self of the waking world and of the waker who is in the waking world. I'm the self of the dream world, and I'm the self of the dreamer who is in the dream world. There's only one self. The other interesting thing there is when I'm dreaming, there's a dreamer in the dream world, right? That negates the experience of the waker in the waking world. These are two different worlds. From the standpoint of the self is there as the self of both. And in the Makara, in the third pada, the Makara, the deep sleep. I am the self of the deep sleep where there is no experience of duality. And from the standpoint of Ishvara, I am the self of that causal condition, the one that is responsible for the manifestation of the entire creation, the one in which the waking state and the dream state resolve into. That is Ishvara. That's the what we call the Maya Upadi. So I am the self of Ishvara. I am the self of Hiranyagarbha. I am the self of Virat. So now that's a jump for the mind. The mind is only halfway there. But this, because it's halfway there, in the sense of, in this way, that I am the self of the mind, what that means is that you are completely intimately known to yourself as yourself. You already know yourself, but you only know it as your mind and body. Right, because of this superimposition. That makes things very tricky. Because you know yourself so well as you, but you only know it in the form of your body-mind complex. Right? And you don't have any doubt about that. Because your mind is correct. It's correct as far as it goes. You know, and so this self that you are is the self that you're intimately attached to. You couldn't be more attached to you because it is you. It is Brahman. It's the truth of everything. You are that truth. And that it is Ananda. It is the beloved. And so you already are that. And you already know yourself as that. But your mind knows yourself as that, and since the mind always enjoys you, it takes you to be it and it to be you. Like A is B and B is A. You know, that shows identity. But this is not the case here. It's A is B, but B is not A. Right? That's the problem. That because A is B, and that's true, you know, then it's hard to go from to B is not A. So what you'll do instead is have the A is B, that means this mind is the conscious being. Now I have to gain knowledge of the big self, Brahman. But I've already negated the possibility of me being Brahman because I'm the mind. See what I mean? And so the eye of the mind is not what we're talking about. The eye of the mind is me. And I am limited. I'm not limitless Brahman. I'm the eye of the mind. Huge problem because I negate myself before we start. See what I mean? I'm negating the beloved. I'm negating the beloved as being the one that I'm seeking. The beloved is going to die. The beloved is going to die because the beloved is the body-mind sense organs. That's what really matters to me. And then I, this one who is finite, has to discover some limitless Brahman that is supposed to be meaningful to me. When it's not meaningful to me, I am meaningful to me. And so what liberation is, really, is the recognition that the I that is meaningful to me, that is me, that I is Brahman. But the only is limitless, is the self in all beings. But the only way I can get there, right, is to have a viveka, a discrimination between the mind and all of the thoughts, all of the moods, all of the emotions, all of the experiences that are coming and going in the mind, in the body, in the sense organs, this whole world of experience that is coming and going, I have to be able to differentiate that from me, who in fact is not coming and going. to recognize that this mind is me, but the me that it is not coming and going. And that is something I can recognize. That I can recognize. And when I recognize that, there's a wonderful logic that I can apply to all of my experience. It's this anvayavyatireka. This shows, the anvayavyatireka shows a complete identity. When this is, that is. When this is not, that is not. If that's the case, there's an identity. That the one is totally dependent on the other. When this thing is, that is. When this thing is gone, then that is gone. Because they're dependent on each other. There's an identity there. But what about when this is, that is. And when this is gone, that still is. And what does that mean? That means that there can be a dependence on one side, right? Because if I say when this is, that is, well, maybe this is dependent on that. That could be. But when I say when this is gone, that still is, then this thing is independent. Right? You could say this could be dependent on this, but if this goes away and this remains, then this side is not dependent at all on this. And so in your world of experience, your I, the conscious being that you are, has to be differentiated. The one that doesn't go away. When this is, that is. When this is gone, that still is. That one who doesn't change, who doesn't go away, has to be differentiated from what is coming and going. And I'm talking about in the immediacy of your experience, not some meditative searching for an experience that is not here now. It has to be this. When this is, that is. When this is not, that still is. So in my experience right now, what cannot be negated? Where is this me? Who is the me that can't be negated? And so that is the satya-mitya relationship. I have to be able to recognize if I'm sitting, like we did that meditation, when I'm sitting with this body, in this body, and I can say, I am this body. That's a very good meditation, right? Because the self is the body. It's just free of the body, but it is the body. So let's let it be the body. It is the body. It is the mind, it is your thoughts, it is your emotions. So sit and say, okay, here I am, I, this body. And single out your own presence, what makes you you, this very, the me-ness, the me of your body. You know, the me of your thoughts. This what the one that you know as you already. The one who is there present to every thought. It's a very personal me. So just notice it. Why can't we notice that? The thoughts are coming and going, and they're all coming and going in me. I'm not coming and going. That's the anvayavyatireka. So it's so simple that we're taken aback by it. It's too simple. Yourself is too much you. And when we think of big words like liberation and moksha, you know, and enlightenment and all these words, well, it's certainly not going to be me. I have to have a big experience for that. And a big one. And that couldn't be just me. But the most profound realization is that this simple me, and is the very me of the body and the mind and the sense organs, that this very simple me is the beloved. There is nothing more important, more dear to you. And that is a revelation. It kind of goes, everybody has this revelation in their own way, but it's kind of like, talking about me. That's a huge surprise for most of us. Yet they're talking about me. The me that is me. That is this me that is Brahman. It is this me. The me that is me. That is the self in all beings. And so what happens has to happen in what we call this akanda akara vritti. As this teaching takes place and the words are guiding you to recognizing what is already very, very present, could not be more present, these words have to guide the mind to, in a sense, take it step by step, breaking the identification with the things that I can objectify. This is a teaching methodology. Say, for instance, like right now, if I ask you to be aware of your body, there's a subject-object relationship there. But what is filling your mind at that time, if I say, just sit and be aware of your body, feel the contours of your body, what is happening in your mind at that time is the perception of your physical body. That's what I'm asking you to do, is to be aware of your physical body. Then I can move in and say, now just be aware of your breath. Now the breath is filling your mind. That's what you're aware of. There's a subject-object relationship there. You're aware of the breath. Then I can say, notice yourself aware of this breath. So it's kind of like taking you on a trip in a way, trying to ask your mind to actually see something, to experience something. But now, what if we then move into the thoughts and I ask you to just be aware of your thoughts, watch your thoughts. Be aware of your thoughts, watch them coming and going, watch your emotions. Just notice that you're aware of those thoughts. We get a little space between me and the thoughts that I'm aware of as I'm watching the thoughts. Now, what if we quieten the mind, relax the mind, relax the body, and then get into a condition where the mind is relaxed enough that I can ask the mind to now just be aware of the awareness. Instead of aware of the thoughts, instead of aware of the breath, instead of aware of the body or the aware of sense perception, you're asking this mind to just be aware of awareness. Okay? What happens there is not the mind itself is something which is illumined by awareness. But we're as though turning the mind into something that now has no objects, right? It's empty now of objects. Of anything objectified, it is now empty of, because I'm asking the mind to just relax into awareness itself, the very one that's illumining it. See, if I notice I'm aware of this thought, but if I ask you, okay, thought, okay, mind, be aware of the awareness that's illumining the thought. What happens to the mind at that time? What happens is what we call an akanda akara vritti. The vritti is the thought modification. And its akara, its form, is akanda. There's no subject-object division there. The subject-object division has been eliminated because the mind now is focused and in a sense, on its own content. It's kind of like a pot focusing on the clay. Right? The mind now is not taking on any type of thought modification. It's as though erasing itself. As though. And so at that time, the only thing that is there present in one's experience is just me, is the self. Without the objectification of the body, without the objectification of the mind or the thoughts or the breath or any type of externalized position or perception. And so then the mind now is resolved as though just in awareness itself, in being itself. And then what is the form of being? What is the form of awareness? Where is there any form? All of the forms that we know or that can be, are gained through sense perception, or through memories, or through thoughts in the mind, you know? Mental modifications of one sort or another. But in this particular type of vritti, there's no mental modification. There's just the subject, which is illumining a mind, which as though reversed itself, and it's just like a mirror to the subject. And they give an example for that, like the candle flame, holding a candle flame up to the sun. If you hold a candle flame up to the sun, the outline of the flame can be there for a moment, but the sun just overpowers it. It overpowers it. The candle flame's still there. But it doesn't have a content at all, which is different from the fire of the sun. So it's overwhelmed. And so when that occurs, it's as though the mind hasn't really entered the self. All that's happened is that the mind itself has given up any content other than the subject. And so because of that akhandakara vritti, from the standpoint of the ajnani, the one that doesn't have self-knowledge, it's as though the self enters the self by the self. Right? One enters the self by means of the self, or by means of the akhandakara vritti, you know, which negates any other type of perception. So I'm just there as my own being. Now that same thing can be talked about where we use this atmana, this instrumental case, is what we call ittambhava tritiya. This is the third case being used as ittambhava. And that would say one enters the atma as the atma. Then one enters the atma as the atma, which means one recognizes that the self that you are is recognized as the self that you are. There is no other self. Right? Mm-hmm. You still need that akhandakara vritti. Otherwise, you need something to break this total, what we call anyonya adhyasa, this total superimposition. But you have to remember that what is happening for the mind as that type of akhandakara vritti takes place is that the ignorance which has caused the mind to identify with me, not the satyam, make that satyam mitya identification where I am the self and the self is me. Right? That false identification is broken. There's not a new self that is gained. What you recognize is, the self that I always am, always have been, and always will be, and am right now, is the self they're talking about. That my being is free, that I am free. So one enters the self by the self, as though, or one enters the self as the self, means the mind recognizes the self as the self that has always been there. It's different than the way we usually gain knowledge. Let me just contrast these two things because I think it might help. In the world, when we gain knowledge using our sense organs, say for instance that, I usually use that painting as an example. What has to happen when I gain knowledge? You can use the lamp. Okay. What happens when we gain knowledge is, first of all, I need to have a thought modification of the object. So here, now I need my sense organs to look. I need the sense organs to actually look at that painting. So I have a thought modification now of the painting. If I wasn't looking at the painting, then that painting goes, it's not in my immediate perception. I'll have a memory of it. Right? But I actually need to bring in the object to know it. In self-knowledge, it's not like that. You're already there. You're already known as yourself. It's already the me, the I. So you don't have anything to gain. There's no type of thought modification of an unknown object that you have to bring in so that you can know it, right? Like say for instance, somebody that you've never seen before walks into the room. Well, you've never seen them before. Now they've come into the room. Now you have a thought modification of that person. And now you can learn something about the person. But before they walked into the room, I mean, the ignorance of them is basically beginningless. Right? But they have to become present. Then you have an experience of them. In this situation, the similar thing is that the ignorance of yourself from the standpoint of the mind is beginningless. It's not like you have a prior knowledge of who you really are. But the self-experience is also beginningless. There's no time when you have not been you. The conscious being that you are has for it, which is itself changeless, has been the constant self of every experience you've ever had. you don't need to bring the self in so that you can have an experience of it. The experience is already here. That's why we say everyone, animals, everybody, mosquitoes, they all have some, what we call samanya jnanam, a general knowledge of themselves, just as me. But the vishesha jnanam, the particular knowledge of I am Brahman, I am the self in all beings, I am changeless, I have no birth and death, the me that I am is the me that has always been here and always will be, is free from time, but I am free, I am Satchit Ananda, I am the Beloved, there is nothing that is desired outside of myself, really. That knowledge I don't have. I have I am me, and I'm subject to death, and I'm here and you are there. I'm limited. I'm happy, I'm sad, depending on how I'm thinking or how I'm feeling. So this me is carrying a tremendous amount of baggage, but it is still me. And so now what happens is I recognize that this me that is me is actually free of all the baggage and always has been. Always has been. And that the me that I am is not eternal in the sense of going on forever. It is timeless. It is timeless. It is the self of time. It is the self in which past, present, and future, you know, pass through. So the being that I am is the being that you are, is the being that Ishwara is the being the whole self comes in, creation comes into manifestation and goes into resolution. That being is me. And I recognize myself. I recognize myself free from the upadis, free from the conditioning agents that had always been associated with me. It had been the anvaya vyatireka, from even though ignorant, from my standpoint, had been complete. When the body is, I am. When the body is not, I'm probably not either. When I am, when the body is, I am. When the body is not, I'm not sure. when the soul is, I am. When the soul is, I am. When the soul travels, if there is a soul, when the soul travels and goes to heaven or hell or reincarnates, do I go with it? Do I go with it, or do I die with the body? It's complicated. I don't know. All I know is when the body is, I am. When the body is not, I'm not sure. Right? And so that's the condition that we start with. You can have a strong faith when the body is, I am. When the body is not, I believe what the Vedas say. I believe what the Bible says. I believe what the Buddhas say. I believe that to be true. And that gives me some
solace.
But I don't really know. I'm so bound by that ajnanam. There's a big difference between belief and faith and knowledge. Knowledge means you know. You know without any doubt. And here you have to understand that what we're talking about, it's not what goes on in different planes of existence, different heaven and hell worlds. I don't know what those are like. I mean, I know what the Vedas say, and I can have faith in the Vedas that, oh, this sounds interesting, and this is what is going on, but I don't know, really. But in terms of yourself, you are here. It's not somebody else's self. And so since you are here, it does not make sense to talk about indirect knowledge. I mean, indirect knowledge of yourself who is here, right? But we do. I mean, you could say, well, you know, the Upanishads say that the self is infinite. I wonder if that's true. I wonder how that could be. That's kind of an indirect knowledge, and you may have some belief in the veracity, you know, of the Upanishads and all, but you study the books and you've heard people talk about it, and you wonder, that's, I would like to know that. That's indirect knowledge. Or this is what the Upanishads say. That's interesting. I would like to know. Right? How could I do that? I have to do, to gain really self-knowledge is to recognize, to know who you are. And that's a direct, immediate knowledge. And that recognition of the self, you know, is the recognition of the self, which is the self-evident conscious being that doesn't need to and cannot be recognized by anyone. What can, because it is the one because whom of whom all things are known. But on the other hand, the mind can have its ignorance removed so that it can differentiate itself from me, the one who is self-shining and changeless. I have a little more to say on this verse about not coming back. We'll have to do it next week, okay?
This I'll come back.
Yeah, you can back, but you know what I mean. Let's just take a moment. Om Purnamidam Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om. No, without division. There's the subject-object division is not there. Okay. See, in every other instance with your mind, you know, there's the awareness is illumining the content of the mind, which is different than the self. But when the mind has really just turned its attention toward the Atma, now the content of the mind is not different from the self. So there's akanda, there's no subject-object differentiation. So there's just only at that time the experience of the self, because usually the mind is objectifying something. But what about when it's not? You could even be sitting there in silence and then awareness is illumining silence. So it's like there's kind of a flat screen there without any objects, but it's still not resolved just into awareness itself. But what about when the focus is just on awareness? Then it's like, I like this, the candle flame, holding mm-hmm. the candle flame up to the sun, because mm-hmm. then you can understand that it's not that the mind goes away, but it has no content other than the self. Mm-hmm. In fact, they even take that example a little farther to, you know, we have these terms, savikalpa samadhi and nirvikalpa samadhi. If when the mind has kind of differentiated itself from just consciousness and has just turned its focus toward consciousness, but is still aware mm-hmm. of itself, the outlines of the mind as though. So it can say, this is... it recognizes its mirrorness still. You know, that's savikalpa samadhi, where the mind is still there, perceivable. It hasn't been kind of overpowered by the self, but it recognizes the content that there's no other content other than the very being that is its self. That's savikalpa. Nirvikalpa is when the absorption is so much that the mind loses its outline, its mm-hmm. the outlines of itself. You know, it's kind of not the same, but like when you can relax your body so much that it's not perceptible. Mm-hmm. So the mind, in a way, it's focused not in the sense of tension, but in the sense of direction, is just so much and so absorbed that it loses the outline of it is not there. Yeah. Okay.
But there are all kinds of kind of vrittis, aren't there?
Well, and you can say that, like, for instance, but this is the one that I'm talking about in this case, where there's just a recognition of me as being free of all of this. You can also, even an open eye, where you recognize that all of this, the Ishvara, you know, that into everything that you're perceiving has awareness as its being, the awareness which you are. That means that the body, mind, sense organs, this upadi, is the ahankara, that identification with the upadi is resolved, and the upadi, the body, mind, sense organs is just recognized as part of the room and not containing your awareness. So in that way, when that's the situation, which should be all the time, actually, once you know, the self, when you recognize that, the self of the subject is the self of the object. Right? In other words, the consciousness that illumines this body, mind, sense organs is the same consciousness that illumines the rest of the room. It's kind of easy to understand this in terms of, say, if I in dream, but I'm going to just use a imagination like the meadow imagination. If you imagine a meadow, with your mind, you imagine a meadow, you know, with yourself walking in it along with your friends, and say there's animals and birds and just the natural sounds of the meadow and the sky and the sun and all this. You just let yourself imagine that meadow. And for you, it is, since it's your imagination, even though it's a complex imagination in which you are like a little jiva within the imagination, it is easy for you to recognize the pervasiveness of your being in the sense that your being is the self of the imagination. That's Ishvara, right? In terms of your imagination, that's the Ishvara condition. Yourself, the subject of your being, the me, is the self not of just you, the one who's walking around in the meadow, but of the entire meadow. The meadow comes from you, is sustained by you, goes back into you. You can appreciate that without very much trouble, I think. Okay? Everybody agree with that? That you can recognize that your being is the self of the meadow and free of the meadow also, in that you withdraw the thought and you are still there. You withdraw the scene and you are still there. The scene comes from you, you know, and when the scene is there, you are there. But you're not contained by the scene, nor by any individual in the scene, right? Now, what is so interesting is that imagination of the meadow is a thought modification. You understand what I mean? Like, I'm having an imagination which is the vritti, the thought modification which my mind is enjoying at that time, which we call a vritti. That thought modification is what my mind is enjoying. I illumine the thought modification. This room is also a thought modification. I have this thought modification, though, is taking place because of my sense organs, which are creating a thought modification in my mind, which I pervade. I pervade every thought modification. I am the self of every thought modification that I have. And so, if in my experience, the imagination of the meadow, it's clear that's a thought modification, And I clearly am itself of the whole thing. Why is it that this thought modification of this room, I can't recognize the same thing?
Yeah.
Because it is exactly the same, but the problem is that I know that the thought modification of in my imagination is subjective, you know, and it's clearly, you know, of my thought, which I pervade. I know that. But here, this room is not my thought modification. The room itself is Ishwara. I'm not creating the room, right? Even though what I'm perceiving is a thought modification. But I'm not the creator of this body, of these sense organs, or of this room. And so the Dehat, what we call the Dehatma Buddhi, this conviction, Buddhi here is the conviction that the self is the Deha, is the body, is so strong, the body-mind, is so strong that even though the situation is exactly the same in terms of the thought modification, now through my sense organs I'm having this thought modification, which is pervaded by my being, the ahankara, the I notion, the I thought, is so attuned to landing on the body that as I'm having this, the mind is also landing back and forth here, you know, checking in with this. And so it doesn't recognize the similarity, experiential similarity between these two thought modifications. But if you know what I'm talking about, then you can imagine a meadow and then open your eyes and recognize that the me is not contained. The conscious me, it's not big, it's not small, it's not contained, and there's nothing away from it. It's not big or small because consciousness is free of time and space. So it doesn't have dimension, but at the same time, nothing is away from it. Like, if right now you imagine a meadow, the meadow can be kind of big. You haven't become big, but there's nothing in the imagination that's away from you, because the whole thing is known, that the whole thing exists, but it's not like the self is stretched out to have the imagination. The self is limitless. It is the ground of being. There is no other ground of being. It doesn't have time or space to qualify it in any way, because time and space come with the imagination, come with the creation. Like if you have a meadow imagination, the time and space exist in the imagination, right? The time and space exist in the creation. When the creation goes into unmanifest condition, if we look at it as cyclical, just like your meadow imagination goes into unmanifest condition, conscious being is not going into unmanifest condition. Consciousness never is awake or asleep, but it's consciousness, right? If the mind is asleep, then consciousness is illumining the sleeping mind, right? If the mind is dreaming, then consciousness is illumining the dream. If the mind is awake as a waker, then consciousness is illumining the waking experience. But consciousness is illumining it not as a verb, but as who you are. Consciousness is consciousness. It's not doing anything. It's just consciousness. That's why as you start getting to know yourself, you can ask questions, you know, you let your mind ask questions like, are you doing anything? The mind is doing something, the sense organs are doing something, your body can be doing something. What are you doing? The me. You're not doing anything. You are the self of the whole thing. And you need not do anything. He said, oh, I'm bored. I'm not doing enough. No, it doesn't feel that way. Because of ananda. The ananda, which is your nature.
Well, this Dehatma Buddhi, does that really go away, or what does it do? I mean, you can tell yourself that...
It becomes mitya. The Dehatma, the conviction of the Atma as the Deha, that goes away. Yeah. But the consciousness which the body enjoys from its own standpoint, as long as it is a living body with a sukshma sharira, a subtle body, pervading it, then it will enjoy consciousness. But that doesn't mean, from its standpoint, It says, I am a conscious being. The mind says, I am a conscious being. If the table could talk, it would say, I'm a conscious being. Because there is nothing but conscious being. That's the truth of the whole thing. So the mind, with the body, as long as it's alive, you know, having a mind and sense organs pervading it, it says, I am a conscious being. But the one who has differentiated me, the conscious being, from the body, knows exactly what this is. Yes, you are conscious being, you're the conscious being, and I the conscious being am free of you. Which is fine. When this, all it means is not to denigrate your body, your mind, your sense organs, but just to recognize that there is no such thing as a death experience. There is no such thing as the self becoming depressed. The mind becomes depressed, but the self, which is very helpful to know if your mind, you know, is going through emotions, working out this and that, the things that the mind has to work out. Your self is there as it is. It hasn't changed. And so, in fact, when that viveka is there, the mind has something to relax into. You know, the mind is subtle, and it's not like physical material. You can relax your mind, you can change your thoughts, you can change your moods and emotions. The great trick to releasing the mind from whatever problems it's having is having the freedom and the space to relax it. Means to not push away the problem, to not run away from the problem, to not stop the problem, but just to let the mind relax. That's different than saying, don't think that. You can try that. Sometimes it works, actually. You know these three levels? Like that in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, these raga dveshas, these upsets in the mind, you can, if they're not too bad, you can blow it away, just like the wind. And that's fine. You can say, you don't have to go down that path, and your mind will go, yeah, I really don't. you relax and it goes away. Another level, you know, you might see your mind getting into a problem, and you can say, you don't have to go that way, just relax. And the mind will say, yes, I do. I need to think about this, and I need to be able to talk about this. It doesn't want to be quiet. It wants to talk about it, wants to work it out. It wants you to be there for it. But you know what? Then you can say that's fine. And what you do, the only thing you do is you be there for it as a friend with some care, like for a child. But you still relax. You say, okay, but you relax. And that's learning how to relax the mind without trying to dismiss it. If you can dismiss it, then you just naturally will, because it's not a big deal. But some of them are bigger deals. And then you can be there for it. You know, that inner child work and that type of dialogue to let the mind tell you what's going on, let the little ones tell you what's going on. When you're letting that happen, if you can relax, it's very healing. And there's a trick in it also. And the trick is that what is creating so much pain is the tension in the mind. Mm-hmm. And so as you're both being a good support to the mind, a good friend to the mind when it's trying, you know, a good parent or good friend, depending on what's going on there. That also is very helpful to the mind, but learning how to relax the mind, like we do that so naturally with the body, you learn how to relax your body. It makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. But you can relax the mind itself, and you find what happens is that the pain and the darkness of the mind dissipates in that relaxation. So that's just it's just something to kind of practice and try. It really helps. And then there are some emotional problems, complexes that we have from childhood and whatnot, that need a lot of tending. Now that's the one, instead of being like cleaning a mirror, it's like the fetus in a womb. it needs to be cared for, and inner child dialogue. And even there, when, even if that complex is tight, if you are not, you know, like a good parent, the one who can relax and give love and care and listen and let that dialogue continue, it's that learning that relaxation that loosens the knot of the in the psyche. You know, just practice of relaxation itself is a huge thing. Even if you don't have any self-knowledge, you don't have to have self-knowledge. Mm-hmm. It helps even if you're a therapist and you're working with your clients and you teach them how to relax into these, to do this inner child work and learn how to relax into these situations. The relaxation dissipates so much of the darkness and the pain. So, but when we're doing it, there's a whole nother level of understanding, you know, that's taking place. Even though this type of work, you don't really have to have self-knowledge to do. But for us, it's very meaningful and helpful. And there's another dimension to it. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. So, would it be fair to say that to really do Nididhyasana properly, basically you do all this stuff to get Antikarana Shuddhi, and then all the vrittis clear out, except the akhandakara vritti, and at that point you just naturally see the self.
Well,
the mind does, the mind, because it's empty.
The mind is, in Nididhyasana, the mind is actually recognizing and sitting with what you see at the time of teaching. You know, so it's not like a new recognition, it's something that every class is pointing toward, and you see it, seeing it continually through the teaching. But now, another thing, just to make sure that what you're meaning here. It's not, with Nididhyasana, well, first of all, sometimes you don't want to do, you don't, your mind's not in a position to do Nididhyasana. It doesn't want to, and it doesn't have to. You know? You know, that's important to know that. But when you do it, it's helpful to kind of know this progression, that you could do the whole progression in 5 minutes or you could do it in half an hour or whatever. Just how to be respectful and a friend to your body, to let your body relax, you know, and to bring in that kind of that attitude of more friendship, to bring in that friendship, that what I call that inner friend to the mind, and let the mind relax, let, there are certain ways of talking to it to make sure that it's not stressed, that it's not holding things that it needs to tell you, just the conscious mind. So give it some space, you know, to relax itself, and then do some inner child work. Does anybody inside have anything to say? You know, if you've done a lot of that, then everybody might just be fine. You can do that in just a moment, actually. But if there's something there to be, discussion to be had, or the little ones inside do have things to say, it's very helpful to give them some space before you start meditating. Because if you start, I consider that as part of the process, because otherwise they don't want to meditate. They want attention.
Yeah, they're and hurt.
They hurt, they want attention, they want to be held, all of these things, and then you want to meditate. And what about me? You know?
Yeah, I can really attest to the fact that my 8-year-old could care less about Vedanta.
Exactly.
She's really light.
Yeah. And so they need some that attention first, and then they will be, they can be fine, you know? And so these preliminary things, if it's just so helpful to try to not bypass that, because then all of the different parts are just slowly moving themselves into that meditative space, the unconscious also, where it's open and willing, and then you can enjoy that. It's very relaxing. It's a very beautiful time. But if there's any bypass going on, then you don't want to do it. You're making yourself do what you want to do. What you think you're supposed to do, you're making yourself do it, but because you're bypassing, it's not very enjoyable and you can't wait to get up. Okay. Can't wait to get up and go do your own thing. You know?
Well, if you do that bypass, they kind of wreck everything for you.
They're upset. Our unconscious can be unhappy, hurt, upset. And like any, when you're hurt, it's nice to have somebody care for you. It's nice to know how to do that self-care. Also, when you're hurt, there's a part of you that isn't. The self is not hurt. The buddhi, that's you know, resting in the self, aware of the self, is not hurt. It can be with the part that is hurt. And then that part is taken care of. Otherwise, we're very dependent on finding someone, you know, who will do that for us if we don't know how to do that ourselves, because you're just left there alone as the hurt person with no one, nothing inside to come and take care of you. But once you gain that type of relation, there's always the you that is there to take care of the ones and the parts that are hurt for this reason or that. You know? Then you don't have that loneliness. The self isn't, yourself's not lonely. Love or wholeness is not lonely. The isolated mind is lonely. You know.
But at some point, there's going to be, even if only for a moment or a short time, or maybe longer, the little ones are going to calm down.
Yeah.
And then there's going to be some kind of shanti, and then this khandakara vritti.
You know what? You're thinking too much about it.
I am.
Yeah, you know why? Because it becomes like a, first this should happen, and then that should happen, and then that should happen. That's a problem with explaining these things. But they're there to be explained, so we're doing that. But we're putting words to something. We're putting words to something that is actually just natural. And then you can say, they're so natural that then you would say something like, oh, maybe that's what they were meaning about the akhandakara vritti. Right, rather than trying to get there by that. It's just that I'm explaining it because it's in the verse. Mm-hmm. And in Vedanta, these things are all explained. And it's useful to explain them also, but then if you get stuck on it, it's not any fun. It's like you have to wait. Is this an akhandakara vritti? Or when's it going to come?
Yeah. So it's kind of, you know it when you see it.
Yeah. I would say, you know, I think one of the greatest things about meditation to understand is all you really have to do is relax and notice yourself. As you relax, the noise of the body and the mind, the perceptions, abate. And as they abate, your being isn't in competition with them. And so everything, all of the teaching, everything that's being taught, you start to understand what all of these words mean. You understand it at the time of teaching, at least hopefully. What happens is as you're listening, there's glimpses where you see what the teacher is talking about. You just see it. It's just they're little, sometimes Swamiji's called it, they're just little tiny akhandakara vrittis. Mm-hmm. Boom, boom. You know, you see it. That's what it is. That's what we're talking about. It's not like, you know, you can think, okay, now, so at some point as this teaching is going on, I'm going to have an akhandakara vritti. And then what's going to happen is I'm going to be gone. I won't know anything. I'll just be gone in samadhi. But it isn't like that. That would be very unusual. You know, kind of a Ramana type samadhi, gone. And the people come, should we wake her up? should we? How is he going to eat?
so this
is the seeing, glimpses of seeing. Yeah.
This noticing is not an involved process. I mean, it's almost sound like it'd be split second. In a way.
Yeah, like a split second. You have to remember that you are not a split second. You are the constant.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And that split second of seeing is enough for you to always see. And the reason is, mm-hmm. is that you're never not there. It's just you never recognized mm-hmm. the freedom of your own presence. But once you recognize the freedom of your own presence, You never go away. You always have been there, always will be there. Mm-hmm. It's just that it's always only been entangled from the standpoint of your mind. It's always only been entangled with the mind, right? That's what we call this mutual superimposition.
You said that the self is never lonely, but the isolated mind could be lonely.
Yeah. It's got, you know, the water bucket?
Right.
If I throw a bunch of mud in the water bucket, the sun seems to be dimmed. And that's the experience of depression or loneliness or isolation.
But the, like your psychology, I mean, that's just natural to you, to your mind. And so there are certain conditions, like, having friends or family that maybe not, each of them isn't absolutely, you don't need that to feel full and complete, but in the psychology of your mind and body is, does in a way need certain things to be peaceful.
Whatever it needs, fine. But yourself is always present to whatever the mind is needing or not needing. So say the mind is wishing that you had company. That wishing or longing for company, right, is taking place in a self which is full. You understand? So, and that the fullness of yourself doesn't come and go. But the fullness of the mind, like the sun reflected in a water bucket, definitely comes and goes. And there's nothing wrong with being a human being. You know, like, human beings, in all the studies that we've done, and just from your own experience, even if you're an introvert as opposed to an extrovert, you still need people in your life and animals. You need humans. You need humans, you know, that to relate with. You long for that, you know, in some way. The other side of that is that the mind doesn't really need that when it has fallen in love with the love itself, the nature of the self. And then it doesn't really make that much difference. But there's the human need for company and that kind of thing, but doesn't really care. I still like people.
Because they do.
Yeah. Yeah, animals are so wonderful. I think we should stop. See, we're getting later and later. Swamiji used to stay out sometimes until, in Rishikesh, you know, he'd have like a chaise lounge type of thing out of bamboo and wood. It's really nice. He used to sit out like sometimes till 1 in the morning. And his, you know, a group would stay up with him.
Yeah.
I'd usually leave around 11 or so. Yeah, that was amazing. I could never do that. So don't worry.